Hey there. We at Blue Wire just wanted to take a second to thank you for listening to this podcast. We know everything outside is pretty scary and uncertain, but we're committed to helping you get through your day by talking about the sports and teams that you love most. If you're looking for more great podcasts to distract you, check out BlueWirePods.com. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the podcast and stay safe.
Fans, and welcome to another episode of Bulls HQ, a Chicago Bulls podcast on the Blue Wire Sports Podcasting Network. We are brought to you today by Bet Online. Thank you to them for sponsoring the show, and thank you to you for joining us on this episode of the show, one where Fred and I will be thankfully talking about The Last Dance. It has been brought up from June, it's been brought up to April. I'm sure everyone's tuned into the first two episodes now, and just about pretty much every NBA podcast that exists out there is probably talking about the same thing. Fred and I wanted to do the same, obviously, given that this is a Chicago Bulls podcast. And Frederick, I can't wait to have this discussion with you today.
Oh, good. I'm eager to have it too. I mean, I've had very few experiences in front of a TV like that. What a great opening salvo from The Last Dance, and I'm sure you're excited to talk about it too.
I am, mate. And I mean, I'm excited for a number of reasons. One, because of the content that we just, you know, got to witness. It was 2 hours of the best TV I've watched in a damn long time. So from a pure, you know, TV watching experience, it was amazing. But just thinking about it, how it sort of relates to us more specifically as Bulls fans, and I don't know, I had the ability or the self-awareness to realize that this has probably been the best couple of weeks as a Bulls fan in a long, long time. And it's going to continue for the next few weeks as we sort of go through the remaining episodes of this docuseries as we proceed towards the episode 10. But I mean, last time we spoke to the listeners, we were speaking to TJ McBride about a tourist kind of Chauvis coming on board. And the fact that guard packs were out and all the changes that were happening to the current day Bulls, and how for a long time the Bulls fan base was unified in how we were feeling and how happy we were. But then to sort of follow up all that to now where we're sort of talking about already living the Jordan days, the Dynasty days, the Last Dance, Doco, it's just so good.
It's great. The only thing that could ruin this is if you know, the next 5 weeks ends and Jim Boylan's still the head coach of Chicago Bulls. That's the only thing that would ruin it for me. But because, I mean, you gotta purge people from the organization like Jerry Krause. You just have to. And, you know, the thing is, it's been with me for so long, 20 years, and watching it again, I keep on telling people like, Fred, you know, I remember all those titles extremely well. You're probably, you know, a little younger than me. Do you remember it at all? Do you remember their titles at all? Or is it, where do your memories start for the beloved Bulls, Mark?
Yeah, so it's interesting for me because I think my experience is most certainly different to yours for a number of reasons. One, I'm a little younger. Well, a lot younger, let's be honest.
Yeah. But 5 or 6 years younger.
Yeah, 50. But apart from that, I think obviously being on the other side of the world, I mean, I think that gives me a bit of a different experience, or I experienced it differently than what you and a lot of people obviously in Chicago or even the United States did. And for me, you know, if we're talking about sort of 97-98, during that run I was probably 10 years of age, so I was young. So even if I was based in the US, I probably wouldn't be able to consume it or remember things the way I do with the current day Bulls. I mean, that's just how it is. Mm-hmm. But yeah, a lot of my following of that era I did during the time. I wasn't into basketball like I am now. I mm-hmm. probably caught one or two games a week that they were showing in Australia, but obviously the internet wasn't what it was back then as it is today. So following the team on a day-to-day basis wasn't really possible like I do now. So a lot of my reliving of that time, that's the key word. I've had to relive it because I didn't necessarily get to experience it in that specific day and age until probably 5 or 6 years later when the internet picked up. I was getting a little bit older and I was able to fully invest myself into it. So it was probably around the 2002-2003 period where not only was I sort of delving more into that Krause rebuild and that specific era of Chicago Bulls and following that on a day-to-day basis, but I was also at, probably at that time able to catch up and find out what the dynasty meant. So reliving it in 2002, you know, trying to, you know, constantly reading about it and reliving it since then and doing so now, it's been an experience.
I think what's a little bit different for me and some fans that are older that can remember, you know, I remember when Michael was drafted, I was a child, but, you know, I was the excitement that came and almost immediately thereafter. And for a city that had such a loser reputation for almost two decades, he like overnight transformed it into, you know, the capital of the sports world, really. He's the biggest, he was the biggest thing outside of Muhammad Ali, probably, that the sports world had seen. And the thing that also I think people forget is, people that really loved the Bulls, we kind of grew up with the team in that if you go back to 1987-88, the Bulls lost to the Pistons in the conference semifinals 4-1. The next year in 88-89, they got to the conference finals and lost 4-2. The following year in 89-90, they lost 4-3. How many organizations or teams in today's world would be allowed to go three straight years losing to the same team? Every year getting a little bit closer, but can you imagine the frustration, imagine the anger across the fan base? I don't even think it would be allowed, you know, and with the transit, and then still remaining the three major players was, you know, Michael, Scottie, and Horace in that ascendancy. And I hope they really go over that in the next, because, you know, Scottie really grew up through that. You know, so you kind of grew up, you love this team, and then overnight, he wins the title. They win 4-0 against the Pistons, 4-0 against the Pistons. They start winning titles. And overnight, he transformed Chicago into this city that was basically associated with Al Capone, a complete loser, and a city of losers, over into a city of championships and six titles over 8 years. It's really hard to describe the transformation I saw.
Yeah, I mean, that's the part I'll just never get to live and feel, I guess, what it must have been like to be watching this, recalling, you know, you as a fan at that time, obviously witnessing it live, going to games. I mean, seeing Michael Jordan in person is something that I can never do. Mm-hmm. So that aspect of it is just something as a fan that I just can't ever recall or can't ever get back, like that experience, which sucks in a way, but I'm thankful at the same time that we do have the ability to catch up on that sort of stuff. And I guess, you know, memorize or just go relive it all, because that's why this has been such an important documentary for us Bulls fans, that ability to relive it all and just go into the details that of some things that we may or may not have already known. I think a lot of us probably who have done our research, me, for example, but maybe less so for you who's lived through it, but we sort of know the main talking points that we went over in episodes 1 and 2. And obviously, as we sort of go forward, I'm sure that will be the case. But there was some details throughout the first couple episodes that I wasn't familiar with, and probably more so in the Scottie side than the Jordan side. Obviously, there's been a lot of work done in terms of who Jordan is and who he was about his career. There's been a lot of tell-all stories from a Jordan perspective that we have access to, but it's probably more the Scottie stuff that was more of a revelation to me. I don't know if it was for you, but just that detail that we are getting now, whilst at the same time getting to see film footage of just Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen play basketball at a time where there is literally no basketball being played. I mean, yeah, it's so refreshing. It just feels so good.
So, I mean, watching this again, though, it was bittersweet because it brought back all that pain and agony I had to feel every offseason, where my friends and I were just debating whether or not they were going to come back. There was always a contract issue with either Dennis Rodman, Phil Jackson, or Scottie Pippen. Scottie Pippen was complaining about his contract. There was always some kind of off-court drama that really, I don't want to say it ruined it, but it definitely left the experience. It hurt the experience. It should have been a celebration, and there was always this in the background, this noise in the background that was considerable and painful. And it just hit you in the first two episodes. I mean, were you aware of this? Did you understand did you have any idea like what was going on in the background with this at all, Mark? Or is this news to you?
So when I was experiencing live as a kid internationally across the world, it was probably stuff that I vaguely, very loosely knew about from like a headline and maybe reading a couple articles here and there. But in terms of getting into the dynamics of it all, or understanding it from a cap perspective, or understanding what other options were available, that stuff I had to learn over the years. And like, for example, the understanding the cap manications of 1997 or, you know, 1994 or 1995, all those years where they were potentially thinking of trading Scotty for whoever it may have been at the time. Those sorts of things I had to learn in years after, and understanding how the cap worked then, understanding who was available, understanding the free agency rules, understanding there was different CBAs at that point. So that inner detail is stuff that I probably didn't know at the time that I've learned over time. But even now, watching the first couple of episodes now, I'm still learning stuff. Like, even in preparation to The Last Dance, the fact that they would have to... I read an article that Jordan was close to going and signing with the Knicks, and that was probably something I didn't really fully appreciate or understand probably before last week, and maybe other fans who had a different perspective on that. But the fact that Scotty obviously felt the way he did for so many years about his contract, but even Jordan, the way the Bulls sort of dealt with Jordan's contract status throughout the years, it's just a bad reflection on the two Jerrys involved in here. And to me, they were probably more so Krause, but less so Reinsdorf. But Jerry Krause was most certainly painted as the villain in episodes 1 and 2. We can discuss whether that's fair or not, and I want to get into that in a bit more detail. But to me, watching back episodes 1 and 2, and you and I have done this, and we didn't really want to record straight after watching episodes 1 and 2 because there was just so much to digest that you and I wanted to watch this back a million times, and we've done that since it aired. We've watched it back a few times, and every time I've seen it, I just can't get past the idea that Jerry Reinsdorf just allowed all this to happen. I know we can talk about Jerry Krause and all that he did wrong and right, but the fact that Reinsdorf sort of just allowed all of this to sort of just happen under his watch, I just can't get past that.
I agree with you. I part of me also says, well, at least he did it. He did some efforts. I mean, there was a story that came out today that with Tim Floyd, where Tim Floyd did an interview for an ESPN outlet in Louisiana, that Jerry Krause wanted to break up the team after the 72-10 season, after their fourth title. And they actually met, Jerry Reinsdorf met with Tim Floyd in Seattle about the head coaching position. I mean, to just think about that for a second, how mind-boggling that is. They just had 72 wins, and this jackass Jerry Krause wants to break up the team. It's nauseating. So to Reinsdorf's credit, he stepped in and made sure it didn't happen. They won Title 5, and he came back one more year, and they won Title 6. But I agree with you. I think in the end, what should have happened is what happened to every great champion, whether it's Muhammad Ali, whether it's the New England Patriots, whether it's the New York Yankees. You go out on your shield. Nobody goes out on a win and acts like, oh, this is the greatest thing ever. It's a tragedy to me that the Bulls didn't have a chance to go for number 7 in 1998-99. Wennington was on the radio this morning here in Chicago, and the question was posed to him, could they have won in that shortened season? He said, yes, yeah, they could have. Rodman said the same thing, and I believe it too. I think they could have put it together for one more run, and to lose out on an opportunity for that and get 13 wins, you know, to satisfy this GM's ego, it's nauseating. And in the end, it comes down to this. It was cheaper, far cheaper to be loyal to Jerry Krause than it was to be loyal to Michael Jordan. If you're going to be loyal to Michael Jordan, it was going to cost a lot of money, probably between $30 and $40 million for Michael, a lot of money to Phil Jackson for a year, and a lot of money for multiple years to Scottie Pippen. It was a lot cheaper to take a full house for the next 5 years with 19 wins per year and a young team under Jerry Krause. And I think that's what happened.
Yeah, I mean, we can defend Reinsdorf for making the decision to step in after 96 or stepping in after 97 and saying, as long as Jordan's around here, then we're going to go for title number 6, even though Jerry himself sort of suggested that, you know, within the first few minutes of the documentary, I was already pissed off at Reinsdorf because he was sort of suggesting that they were considering blowing it up after title 5. And obviously they did that after title 6, but he ultimately chose Jerry Krause over Michael Jordan, over Phil Jackson, over Scottie Pippen, over the entire dynasty. I mean, the fact that those three in particular, not to mention all the other role players that sort of exited the franchise thereafter, the fact that he chose Jerry Krause and enabled that rebuild at that point, to your point, without allowing the team to sort of just fall on their sword naturally. I mean, the rebuild was always going to be there. It was always an option. The decision to get ahead of it and maybe trade a player once they still had some value rather than losing them in free agency or whatever it may be, or, you know, they naturally retire, whatever it might be, you know, not necessarily recouping that full value of an asset. I understand the pure theory of it all, but at some point you just have to write it out and live through it all. And the fact that Jerry Reinsdorf to this day picked Jerry Krause, it is mind-boggling. Now, obviously, we know that the rebuilding years with Krause didn't go to plan, and maybe if a few things break a little bit differently, maybe if Tim Duncan signs here, maybe if Tracy McGrady signs here, maybe we're thinking about Jerry Krause a lot differently. But facts being what they are, Jerry Reinsdorf picked Jerry Krause, and we entered into 5 years of terrible Bulls basketball.
Yeah, but they were never going to sign with him just because of that reason, because they did, quote-unquote, Michael wrong.
That's fair.
Dwayne Wade brought that up in 2010. Kevin Garnett brought that up in 2020. That sin continues, the ramifications for that sin continue to this day. And that's why I have him a little bit. I feel for John Paxson, what he had to endure in that, you know, that a lot of those, being a GM and getting those guys to come here in 2010, he was, I think that stuff hurt them. Dwayne Wade said it. So, you know, that's something that will never be erased until, you know, probably until Jerry Reinsdorf no longer owns the team. I will say things are definitely turning better, you know, with his son, who seems to be more, definitely, you know, a little bit more eager to change things up and to look in a new direction. And everything I've heard about him has been fantastic. But you can't argue that that had just disastrous ramifications. Nobody was ever going to sign here with Jerry Krause. The guy was just, he was almost a psychopath to me. Like, the more I read about it, he just had serious personality. He had a serious personality disorder. And a lot of the people who I know who worked with him didn't like him for that. I'm sure at some point he was nice to his family and he was a nice guy, you know, personally. You hear various things, right? But overall, if you're in that job, you have to find out, do whatever it takes, even if it means resigning, to make sure Michael Jordan does not leave and end his career in Washington. It's a disgrace.
Yeah, I mean, the whole Krause discussion is fascinating in a lot of ways. And I mean, Bill Wennington said it, that, you know, Jerry Krause was a really nice guy. So it ultimately comes down to your interaction and relationship with the person for people to cast judgment of whether this person was good, bad, or otherwise. And I know Scotty and Michael probably feel a lot differently, maybe Phil too, but there are clearly people that had positive relationships with Jerry Krause. But I guess the sucky part of it all is the fact that he's being painted as a villain, and I know a lot of fans listening to this may already or feel that he is, and I certainly understand why he is that, and I'm not necessarily suggesting he's not. I don't want to come across as defending Jerry Krause at all, but it kind of does suck that he isn't here to maybe tell his side of the story, if there is anything necessarily to tell, but it would be good to understand his perspective a little bit more. I think that was interesting as well, watching this back and watching back those old clips of how candid he was in those, you know, those media discussions or those footage that we did have of Jerry Krause, like how candid he was about Phil Jackson. Basically, this is his final year. He's not coming back, and actually going out and saying that in public is just kind of crazy when you think about today's game. Like, that is nothing that would ever be said ever, even if that's actually what's going on in the background. The way he was so openly discussing Scottie Pippen's contract, the fact that they were openly shopping Scottie Pippen, you just don't hear that language used, that candid use of the way he candidly spoke to the media. You just don't witness or see that anymore. So that to me was quite illuminating as well. But I don't know. Like, this was always going to happen, given that Michael Jordan has creative control over this project or this docuseries that we're watching. But Jerry Krause was always going to be painted as the villain, which look, fair or otherwise, it is what it is, but it does kind of suck that we don't get to hear him don't get to see his input into it beyond, obviously, the archival footage that we have available to us.
I highly doubt he would even participate.
Yeah, and, maybe not. Maybe not.
You know, in retrospect, you look at his career, he was GM for almost two full decades. And the two best moves he did by far were acquiring Pippen on draft day and drafting Tony Kukoc in the second round. Horace Grant draft pick. I spoke with Horace Grant before Bulls Outsiders gig for 2 hours, and he admitted that Jerry Krause did not want to draft him. Doug Collins wanted him, and the staff wanted him. They went directly to Reinsdorf over Jerry's head. Reinsdorf spoke with him. And, you know, to his credit, Krause did officially make the pick for Horace Grant, but if Doug Collins wasn't involved, we would have had Joe Wolf. And then you look at Rodman. Rodman was a no-brainer. You traded Will Perdue for Dennis Rodman. Dennis Rodman had just burned every bridge he had ever made in San Antonio. He was considered unmanageable. No coach would have ever tied their fortunes to Dennis Rodman. He took off his shoes during a playoff game. It goes on and on. Google and look at it, the adventures of Dennis Rodman in San Antonio. But the weight of Michael Jordan's reputation and Phil Jackson, as a great coach that he was, were able to rein him in and bring him on board. So all the heavy lifting was done by Michael Jordan, Phil Jackson. That move worked out because of those two, not because of Jerry Krause. And then you just look at all the picks that this guy had: Brad Sellers, Mark Randall, Byron Houston, Dickie Simpkins, Jason Caffey over Michael Finley, Corey Benjamin, Marcus Fizer, Dalibor Bagaric, Eddie Curry, all number one picks. The guy fell flat on his face. And in my opinion, there has been no one more overrated. I'm almost embarrassed to say on that number seven list that I didn't put him as number one. I should have done it.
See, I'm prepared to give Jerry Krause far more credit as a general manager, as an influence on this whole dynasty than what you are. And I understand why you have this venom toward him. And maybe it's going back to what we sort of spoke about before earlier on in terms of how our Bulls fandom was shaped and the ability that we had to live through it. So maybe my experience is a little bit different to yours, and I wasn't sort of in the coal fire there living in Chicago, experiencing it on a day-to-day basis like you were, and like how you were explaining, just wondering if your favorite team, you know, that the team that had Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Phil Jackson, whether that was going to be blown up for some odd, strange reason. Like, I didn't experience that, so maybe my perspective is different. But I'm prepared to say that Jerry Krause was a great GM, and whilst also prepared to say he was a crazy man that made just some epic, disastrous decisions. I think there's room for both things to exist, or both narratives to exist. And obviously, we're getting the picture at the moment that Jerry was the villain in all this, and again, not surprising based on who was involved in producing and making this documentary. But I think there is some room to suggest that Jerry was a really good GM. He was influential in building this roster. Obviously, walking into a team that has Michael Jordan, it's a lot easier maybe to build with a team with Michael Jordan than obviously without. But I think it was still something that Jerry deserves credit for, I guess, is my point. And
I just don't see how you can make that case when you consider that the team after Michael Jordan left averaged 19 wins over five seasons and was by any measure an unequivocal disaster.
Because I just don't see you can make that. I think it's possible to separate things and compartmentalize things. I think, I mean, guard packs are exiting right now. Obviously, we have... Well, maybe not less so you, but for me at least, I don't have fond memories of the Garpax era over the last sort of 4 to 5 years. But in saying that, despite my intense hatred for what has sort of transpired over the last few years, I still have the ability to recognize that through 2003, maybe up until 2011-12, there was a lot of good there. So I think you can sort of do both things. You can say, all right, for this period of time, Jerry Krause was really good. Thereafter, he made that epic decision, just a disastrous decision to blow it up. Obviously, enabled it to happen, or Jerry Reinsdorf enabled it to happen. But thereon, that obviously completely fell over and it was a terrible experience for everyone involved. So I think we should have the ability to sort of recognize that there was two different eras, two distinct versions of Jerry Krause as a GM, and one he was really good at, and one obviously failed miserably. So I don't know. Again, maybe my experiences growing up through all this maybe allows me to view it from a different perspective, but I understand how you feel the way you do, and I understand why Jerry Krause has been painted as the villain that he is. But in saying that, I also do think that, you know, what was quite revealing as well is that Michael Jordan, I mean, building a team around Jordan, despite him being obviously the greatest player of all time, which all of us listening to this probably agree with, I think there's probably not a general manager or an owner out there who wouldn't have clashed with Michael Jordan at one point in time. And I go back in, or I'm saying this because in episode one, the first episode was about Jordan, the second episode was more so about Scottie, but in episode one, we go back to 1996, where Jordan obviously has that foot injury, misses most of the season, comes back on a minutes restriction, obviously wants to come back and start playing as much as he can. But the Bulls are trying to, quite unquote, let's say they were trying to tank at that point, which kind of makes sense. But obviously, Michael was wanted nothing to do with that. And from that point on, that's probably where his relationship with Jerry Krause started to fracture. So whether it was Krause, whether it was someone else, it was probably always going to be difficult to manage Jordan just because of his insane will and his insane drive to play the way he did and compete the way he did.
I think there's a massive difference between, you know, trying – if that game wasn't to make the playoffs, I'd understand it. That game was to try to make the playoffs. It's not remotely comparable to trying to tank, because the Bulls had an opportunity to make the playoffs. You should always try to make the playoffs. It's my general opinion on everything. I had no problem with them in 16-17 trying to make the playoffs. You know, I think it's always better to, you know, get that experience that Michael got. And that, in retrospect, was absolutely true. I've heard people try to argue otherwise. I disagree completely. That's part of what made Michael Jordan. 86 Celtics, most people would argue, are one of the best teams of all time. He threw 49-63 on them, and the legend started building from there.
Yeah.
You know, it was clear. You know, so, I mean, without that, I don't think – if you didn't have that series, who's to say that, you know, everything else would have happened after it? Probably, but you never know, right? You know, if we – I don't know. It's a tough argument. I mean, to me, big picture – I always go back to this Emerson quote, which I love, Ralph Waldo Emerson. And one of the things is, what a success, to laugh often and much, to win the respect of intelligent people and the affection of children, to earn the appreciation of honest critics, endure the betrayal of false friends. Respect of intelligent people. You look at the people that were talking about Michael Jordan last night, Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, James Worthy, and just the quality of individuals that went on and on about Michael Jordan. What was the best thing said about Jerry Krause? I think it was Bill Wennington said he was a nice guy. And nobody else believes that. You know, he might have been nice to Bill. You know, that's all you need to do. That's all you need to say. All you need to say. I agree. Michael was probably unfair and vicious to him. What the heck is Krause doing on the bus anyhow? What GM rides the bus with the team? That was part of the problem, part of my anger with this whole thing. What are you doing inserting yourself in with the team like that? That doesn't happen. No other people acted like that. He had this sick, pathetic, you know, he was the fat, short kid in high school, got probably picked on, and he desired to be a member of the team. And you know what? To his credit, he did a good job, at least for the, you know, building a championship team. But when Michael left, I think we all saw his true colors.
We're clearly not going to agree on Jerry Krause, which is fine. In saying that, I want to continue talking about it. And the reason why I say that is because the Krause-Jordan dynamic is just going to be clearly, based on the way it's been set up in the first two episodes, it's going to be a dynamic that sort of plays out through the entire narrative of this docu-series. But I want to talk more about it. But before we do, I want to tell the listeners about this week's sponsor, BetOnline. With currently no NBA, NHL, or MLB, you might think there's nothing to bet on. Well, you'd be wrong. Our exclusive partner, BetOnline, still has hundreds of events, games, and props to wager on. From their online casino to poker and blackjack, they are bringing Vegas to you. Missing the NFL? Then no problem. BetOnline has live, daily Madden NFL 20 simulations that you can bet on. You can also still bet on Survivor, Big Brother, American Idol, stock prices, and even Nathan's hot dog eating contest. All of that is open 24 hours a day and is all online. Use promo code BLUEWIRE to join today and receive your new welcome bonus. BetOnline, your online wagering solution. All right, back to the podcast now. Clearly, we've been talking about Jordan, about Scotty, about Jerry Krause, and who in fact is right and wrong. And I think, Fred, this is probably the most interesting thing, or the biggest reflection I had after watching the first two episodes, and I dare say this is going to be a continuing theme throughout the rest of the series, but depending on how you look at it, it kind of feels like there's enough blame to go around for everyone, maybe less so on Michael Jordan. I think the way this docu-series is going to be painted, Jordan's going to come away looking pretty damn good, whereas maybe that's not necessarily the case for others. And yeah, he should. And we were talking about 1986 and the fact that he wanted to play, the fact that the Bulls wanted to maybe keep him out or keep him his minutes low, trying to protect their asset and not necessarily risking his career. But depending on the lens you apply or whose perspective you're looking at it through, I understand why certain things happen the way they did. Like from a Jerry Reinsdorf perspective, from a pure business point of view, I understand why he didn't want to play Michael Jordan in 1986. Or I understand why Jerry Krause would be mad to find out that, you know, Jordan was out of, or back in North Carolina playing an hour and a half that day, despite doctors telling him maybe he shouldn't be, just being a complete maniac. So I understand why Jerry, as from a Jerry Krause perspective, why dealing with Michael Jordan would be completely difficult. But as you sort of alluded to before the break, I completely understand from Jordan's perspective why playing was the right decision as well. And, you know, thankful he did, because we got to saw what he did against the Celtics in the playoffs in 86, that obviously the 49 in game one, and then that epic game two in 60, the 63 point performance, which you referenced before. I mean, I'm glad he did all that, but yeah, I just have this overwhelming feeling that there's enough blame to go around, whether it's Jerry Krause, whether it's Jerry Reinsdorf, even Scottie Pippen. And maybe we can transition to talking more about Scottie. But I mean, Scottie doesn't sort of escape any criticism in these first two episodes, particularly episode two, where it was more so about Scottie. I mean, he didn't come away looking that great from that episode either.
Well, I remember that season, and the biggest shock of the whole evening for me was the revelation that Scottie admitted that he delayed his surgery.
Yeah,
because there was a lot of, I remember that summer, I remember a lot of talk, there were whispers, and it was all denied. It was, you know, that was a serious, if that would have been known publicly, that would have been the second biggest blow to Pippen's reputation in the city. Of course, you go back a few years later, and I don't think you can comprehend how big it was when he sat out that 1.8 seconds in 1994. I mean, I remember how furious I was. There were a lot of people just absolutely furious. And if Kukoc doesn't hit that shot, he's no longer on the team. The way it was, he was traded that summer to the Seattle Supersonics. I'm sure you listened to that episode for Sean Kemp. But that was later nixed by the owner in Seattle because the fans didn't want Scottie Pippen. You know, so his reputation, the one thing that bothers me in all these years is I think there's been this kind of bizarre effort to minimize Jordan a bit by glorifying Pippen and asking and kind of portraying him as more than he was. Like, I love Scottie. He was a great player, but he wasn't a closer. There's a massive difference, and even B.J. Armstrong alluded to this in a recent interview I saw. There was a reason Phil Jackson asked Tony Kukoc to shoot the last second, shoot that shot against the Knicks in 94, because Scottie didn't have that gene. Like, there's a gene, the ultimate closer, the nervousness that you have in a game that occurs when you're playing in the final seconds of a game, it helps you on the defensive end, it hurts you on the offensive end. So there's guys that can perform when it matters most, that have the ability to control themselves, like Michael Jordan did better than anyone else. I thought Ben Gordon, you know, Tony Kukoc. And there's guys where they just don't. They just don't perform offensively. Karl Malone, great players. Don't get me wrong. I'd include Scottie in there. He had opportunities against the Suns in 93. You go back and you think of Scottie's career here, very few times, and people will, I'm sure, argue, well, that's because he didn't, you know, he was on the same team with Michael. Michael took all the shots. Yeah, there was a reason Michael took all the shots, because he was good at it and Scottie wasn't. You know, so I don't want to dismiss him, because defensively he was absolutely, you know, arguably the best perimeter defender of all time, and he was extremely important for us to win titles. But he didn't have that gene. That's why the Bulls didn't win in 93-94, and that's why the Bulls actually did do incredibly well in 97 and 98 without him. That's another thing that bothered me about the doc yesterday, is it made it sound like they started out horrible. Yeah, they started out 4-4. They didn't do great to start the year. But before Scottie Pippen came back on January 10th, 1998, the Bulls won 12 of 14 games. They had a 9-game winning streak at one point. They were playing very well without Scottie Pippen. So, you know, people might want to make the argument they could have never won one without Scottie. I don't believe that at all. I think if they did make that trade with Sean Kemp was a force of nature. I think the Bulls with Jordan Kemp, I think Jordan would have come back with Jordan Kemp and Kukoc would have won titles. Maybe not three, definitely two.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting what if, and we can play those what if games throughout the entire series. I mean, going back to when Scottie signed that deal, which was like a key impetus or a key driving storyline through episode two, that Scottie was mad for so long because of that deal that he sort of signed, that he actively signed, so he has to own his own participation in signing that contract. But still, I understood why he was disappointed in all that. But if we're talking about what ifs, assuming Scottie signed a bigger deal in 1991, let's say, or whenever he was up for an extension, or assuming the Bulls gave him a renegotiation and an extension in 95, then the outlook or the makeup of the team changes very much, or very, very much so, that maybe the whole dynasty conversation that we're discussing is completely different as well. So, I mean, Jerry Krause absolutely signed Scottie Pippen to an amazing deal, to the point where that deal was maybe too good. And I don't even know if we're talking about a second three-peat like we are if Scottie Pippen is signed to a different deal. Maybe we are, because to your point, maybe they trade Scottie for someone like Sean Kemp or someone else. And like in 97, the rumors were Tracy McGrady. Do they win in 96? Yeah. Maybe, maybe not. Who knows? Maybe they're better positioned after Jordan to have Tracy McGrady around. And obviously the Bulls tried to sign him in 2001, 2002, whatever it was. I can't remember now, but... yeah, it's just a fascinating to play all these what-if games based on all these fork-in-the-road moments during this 10 or 8 to 10-year period throughout the 90s through the dynasty days. I mean, it's just fun to relive it all. But like I said, Scottie doesn't come away looking good in this for the first couple episodes. And again, to me, there's enough blame to go around. I understand from Scottie's perspective why he would be pissed off, why he was annoyed at Reinsdorf, why he was annoyed at Krause. I completely get it. But then at the same time, I was also thinking, well, Scottie, you were complicit in signing that contract. You didn't necessarily need to do that. I understand why he wanted to, but I mean, he still signed it. Like, you've got to own it too, which he does. But to me, I guess the overwhelming feeling was I just can't blame one person.
It's interesting because I agree with you 100%. I see both sides of that one. Like, I felt like they probably should have maybe around 96 or so said, hey, you know what, how about we tear this up and we'll do another 3-year deal where we'll give you considerably more money or something to that effect, or even an extension. But I also understand, you know, they took a chance in signing that deal. I think Pippen had some back issues when they signed it. Long, you know, there is a give and take for long-term security. And you know, so that's a real tough thing. I understand, though. The thing that really I was kind of shocked at is Jordan was angry about it, and I understand why. Like, Jordan was underpaid for a tremendous amount of years. When they won 72 games, he made like $3 million. He wasn't the highest paid player in the league. It's outrageous how little he made in those years. Now, yes, true, he made it up in 97 and 98 by making, you know, over $60 million. And I all these people are throwing this stuff out here like, well, yeah, he had all those endorsements. That's where he made his money off the court. It doesn't matter. The Bulls were paying him $3 million. They won 72 games. Yeah, Pippen didn't have any endorsements. Yeah, nowhere near what Jordan had. But basically the point was Jordan played out his contract. He didn't complain. And then he realized at the end of the road he was going to get a big paycheck. And he did get that. I think he expected Scottie to do the same. Scottie did get a big paycheck. And to the credit of the Bulls, they did do a sign and trade they did not have to do. And they did make sure he got more money. And he made, you know, considerably more, really nice contract for the time. And I think that's what Jordan was kind of hurt by. He thought that Scottie was being selfish here when, you know, Michael didn't have many more years left. He was older than Scottie, and he felt like he should have played, you know, kind of did things a little bit differently in that final season. You'll see as we get closer to the end of the year, you know, Scottie, he missed two huge free throws against the Indiana Pacers in game 3, which a huge loss. The Bulls could have gone up 3-0. I didn't think it was a shining year for Scottie Pippen. I thought that Michael did most of the heavy lifting that season.
Yeah, 100%. But, yeah, I mean, even Jordan said as much. Like, as much as Jordan made it very clear that Scottie was his favorite teammate or his best teammate of all time, that he even said that when people mutter the words or mutter the name Michael Jordan, they should be saying Scottie Pippen as well. I mean, that's not a direct quote, but paraphrasing there. So he was effusive in his praise for Scottie Pippen, but at the same time, he expressed his disappointment at Scottie for being selfish. So, coming back to what we were saying before, there's plenty of blame to go around, but it was just fascinating. Like, that was the overwhelming thought that I had watching those first couple episodes. But yeah, I just keep coming back to the fact that Jerry Reinsdorf allowed this all to happen, and he could have renegotiated with Scottie Pippen. I understand that he said, don't come back to me in a few years' time. Yeah, I understand that you know, Jerry said that this isn't maybe a good deal for you, Scottie. But at the same time, you have to have the self-awareness as an owner that this is obviously clearly affecting Scottie, but maybe more importantly, it's affecting Michael Jordan. So the self-awareness from Jerry Reinsdorf maybe wasn't there. Maybe that's because he was too focused on baseball, whatever it might be. Who the hell knows? But yeah. I mean, I'm not surprised they played it out the way they did with Scottie from a contractual standpoint based on what they did with Jordan. I mean, They made him work for his extension, not his extension, but his new contract. The years where he was signing those $30 million 1 year deals. I mean, they made Jordan go out there and sort of find a deal where they had to sort of match or beat an offer. I mean, like I said before, I wasn't maybe as familiar about this, but there was periods there where sort of Jordan was thinking about signing with the Knicks, which again, a complete insane what if, but it could have happened if had the Reinsdorfs not sort of stumped up and paid him $30 million or whatever it was.
See, I wasn't aware of that. I still haven't heard that article you're referring to, and I definitely was not aware of that at the time.
Yeah, look, I found this. I was reading a Jack Silverstein thread on Twitter, actually. I think that's where I saw it. I'm pretty sure it was an article on the Tribune from Sam Smith at the time. I could be mistaken. Maybe through the frenzy of sort of consuming all this content over the last few days that I'm sort of muddling up a few different things, but I'm pretty sure that's what I read. So if that's the case and that's the way they're sort of treating Michael Jordan, just having him doing one-year deals for, $30 million. Obviously, we know the situation with Phil Jackson and the fact that he was on one-year extensions because he and Krauss obviously clearly didn't see eye to eye. If that's happening with Phil and Michael and you know those two guys are sort of tied together, then we shouldn't be too surprised at the way this whole thing played out with Scotty, the way it did. And I completely understand why Scotty would be pissed off from that perspective too.
Yeah. It's, in retrospect, it's such an amazing time in Chicago history because the whole city came together following this team. And I compared it to the Beatles. Like the Beatles were my favorite band of all time, and when they broke up there was all the drama around it and everybody was like, oh, it was great, they finished on a high note, and I always was like, no, it wasn't remotely great, in fact it sucked. Like all the Beatles solo stuff, if you would have put it together and took off all the fluff and put it on one album with the best of the four produced, it's still far greater than the sum of the parts. Like that's what should have happened with this Bulls team. They should have been at least given one more shot to win number 7. And eventually go out the way they wanted to. It's just disgraceful. You still come back to the fact that Michael Jordan finished his career for the Wizards. That's appalling. How can it happen?
It is. And look, we'll probably learn more about this in the next upcoming episodes, but the fact that the man retired because there was obviously not an opportunity to come back to Chicago. There may not have been a better opportunity elsewhere, and who knows if he even wanted to go elsewhere after 98. But the fact that you sort of punted the GOAT out of the door and didn't really give him an option to extend his career or to go out the way that maybe we're talking about here, even if it was losing in 1999. Who knows if the team comes back off in the way, same way it did in 98. Maybe it's a different looking team. Maybe Scotty's not there. Maybe Dennis isn't there. Maybe Phil's not there. Who knows? But assuming Phil and Michael are there, like why the hell would you not run it back? Why would the hell would you not just, even from a pure business standpoint, like why would you want to rebuild at that point rather than sort of banking those checks that Michael and Phil and even Scotty will bring that franchise to the day that they sort of are no longer there? Like why would you expedite that process of getting rid of them? And that is just something that I'll never be fully too able to comprehend. And maybe hopefully we'll learn more about that as we go through this series.
Like, who cares if the team's 500, really?
Yeah.
Like, I don't care if they're 6th, 7th seed, 8th seed. At least the team is – you mean to tell me you think the United Center will not be selling out? It's like – it's insanity. It's insanity when you look back in retrospect. I know why he – I really believe deep down if you asked him why he did it, it was cheaper to go with Jerry.
Oh, for sure.
You know?
Yeah, for sure. So, which is sad. It's insane. It's insane. But I guess the last thing I wanted to note, Fred, and again, like I mentioned before, the overwhelming takeaway for me was there was plenty of blame to go around. But the other thing that stood out to me was the dichotomy of player empowerment in today's NBA versus what it was like back then. The fact that, like we sort of alluded to, Michael Jordan had to go out and potentially earn himself a $30 million deal elsewhere or a nice fat extension from the Knicks or whatever it might be, or a free agency offer, put that on the table to the Bulls to get his $30 million or whatever it might be. The fact that Scotty, Michael, even Phil Jackson, the little power they had over Jerry Krause and Jerry Reinsdorf compared to the power that Kevin Durant or LeBron James, these type of players have over their franchises right now. I mean, the fact that that has changed so rapidly over the last 20 to 25 years, it's kind of insane to think that the greatest player of all time had... He clearly had power, but just nowhere near the same amount of power that today's player has. It's insane watching him back.
It is, and it definitely leaves you thinking that players of today definitely have a lot more power than even the greatest of all time ever did.
Yeah, it's
nuts. You know, can you imagine any of this going on with LeBron James? Even remotely. Like, imagine this story now where there's a GM or whoever it may be, you know, saying, telling the, you know, and LeBron wants this guy as his head coach, saying, no, I'm going to bring in this other, you know, cartoon coach from Iowa State to come in to coach the team.
It doesn't happen.
It's insane to contemplate that. Uh-huh. You know, like, it's like, so, you know, I guess all this happened to probably change sports for the better, I suppose, but. Yeah, it just still breaks my heart. I view the whole thing as a tragedy in retrospect. I know the Bulls won titles and that was great, but it should have never ended like that.
Yeah, it's weird. Obviously, look, now I think it's fair to say that it's a good thing that Michael Jordan didn't get his way every time, because we know how bad he maybe was as an owner or as an executive in terms of making his own assessment of player personnel. Jordan wasn't that great in that, so maybe it was good to have someone like Jerry Krause around or whoever it might have been to maybe say no to Jordan on certain decisions that he maybe would have made if he had more control, like someone like LeBron, who himself has made some bad decisions during his time or during his career. But at the same time, thinking about the control and power LeBron has, which he should have, given from a pure income perspective or a pure business perspective, the amount of wealth that he sort of brings to the game now versus the power that Jordan had then, it's just weird, and it's just funny to see how it all sort of all looks now versus then. But Fred, I think we've gone on long enough now about the first couple episodes. I can't wait for the next episodes to drop, and I'm assuming they're going to be probably more on it, featuring Dennis Rodman and Phil Jackson episodes 3 and 4. We'll see how it all plays out. But I'm loving the fact that we don't get to consume this in a binge quality as well, and then the entire world or the entire sporting world or basketball world is sort of converging on a week-to-week basis, consuming this on that week-to-week basis as a monoculture. I mean, it's just, I really am thankful for that. I'm glad it's not a binging experience. So I can't wait to talk to you next week about episodes 3 and 4.
Yeah, me too. I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm really glad that this has been kind of an educational experience for a lot of Bulls fans out there to see what this was like in the city, you know, and it was really a special time, but also bittersweet, obviously, in the disaster that allowed a short man's ego run wild.
I mean, look, there's no way I'm going to be able to convince you that. Jerry Krause, I mean, you're clearly in lockstep here with Michael that Jerry Krause was the villain, and I understand why, but maybe that changes as we go through the next episodes. Knowing how stubborn you are, probably not, but nonetheless, I look forward to talking next week, my friend, about this. But thank you for joining me today. Thank you for the listeners for tuning into this episode of Bulls HQ. Hopefully you've enjoyed it. Obviously, Fred and I are probably a day late getting to our thoughts around this, but like I said from the top, we wanted to digest this again and again. We didn't want to necessarily come straight after and just give you our thoughts straight after, because to be honest with you, my mind was all over the place after the first couple hours of watching this. I wanted to watch it again. It went so fast reviewing it in time, and I'm glad we had that extra day to sort of digest it all. But hopefully you enjoyed this episode of Bulls HQ. We'll be back next week to talk about episodes 3 and 4. But more importantly, hopefully all the listeners of this show, your friends, your family, you're all staying safe out there. And we're hoping that this The Last Dance docuseries has been a welcome reprieve from all the stuff that's going on at the moment. So hopefully you're enjoying that. Hopefully you're enjoying this episode of Bulls HQ. We'll be back next week. Speak to you then, Bulls fans.